On the theological roots of our attitudes toward labor. Man is made to be in the visible universe an image and likeness of God Himself, and He is placed in it in order to subdue the earth. Only man is capable of work, and only man works, at the same time by work occupying his existence on earth. Pope John Paul II, Laborem Exercens, On Human Labor, 1981. We may define labor as any exertion of mind or body undergone partly or wholly with a view to some good other than the pleasure derived from the work. Alfred Marshall, Principles of Economics, 1890. What is work? Normally, we see it as the opposite of play. Play, in turn, is defined most often as action that one does for its own sake, for pleasure, or just for the sake of doing it. Work, therefore, is activity, typically onerous and repetitive, that one does not carry out for its own sake, and that one probably would never carry out for its own sake, or, if one did, certainly not for very long, but engages in only to accomplish something else, to obtain food, for example, or build a mausoleum. Most languages have some word that translates at least roughly as work, but the precise borders between what we designate work, play, teaching, learning, ritual, or nurturance tend to vary a great deal from one culture to another. The particular tradition that has come to shape sensibilities about work in most parts of the world today harkens back to the Eastern Mediterranean, where it is first documented in the early chapters of the Book of Genesis and in the works of the Greek epic poet Hesiod. In both the story of the Garden of Eden and in the myth of Prometheus, the fact that humans have to work is seen as their punishment for having defied a divine creator. But at the same time, in both, work itself, which gives humans the ability to produce food, clothing, cities, and ultimately our own material universe, is presented as a more modest instantiation of the divine power of creation itself. We are, as the existentialists like to put it, condemned to be free, forced to wield the divine power of creation against our will, since most of us would really rather be naming the animals in Eden, dining on nectar and ambrosia at feasts on Mount Olympus, or watching cooked geese fly into our waiting gullets in the land of Cockaigne, than having to cover ourselves with cuts and calluses to coax sustenance from the soil. Now, one could argue that this is simply, in each case, a poetic extrapolation of the two key aspects of what has become our common definition of work. First, that it is something no one would ordinarily wish to be doing for its own sake, hence punishment. Second, that we do it anyway to accomplish something beyond the work itself, hence creation. But the fact that this something beyond should be conceived as creation is not self-evident. In fact, it's somewhat odd. After all, most work can't be said to create anything. Most of it is a matter of maintaining and rearranging things. Bertrand Russell puts it nicely in his essay, In Praise of Idleness. What is work? Work is of two kinds. First, altering the position of matter at or near the earth's surface relatively to other such matter. Second, telling other people to do so. The first kind is unpleasant and ill-paid. The second is pleasant and highly paid. Consider a coffee cup. We produce it once. We wash it 1,000 times. Even work we think of as productive, growing potatoes, forging a shovel, assembling a computer, could just as easily be seen as tending, transforming, reshaping, and rearranging materials and elements that already exist. This is why I would insist our concept of production and our assumption that work is defined by its productivity is essentially theological. The Judeo-Christian God created the universe out of nothing. This in itself is slightly unusual. Most gods work with existing materials. His latter-day worshippers and their descendants have come to think of themselves as cursed to imitate God in this regard. The sleight of hand involved, the way that most human labor, which cannot in any sense be considered production, is thus made to disappear, is largely affected through gender. In the familiar lines from the story of the fall, from the book of Genesis, God condemns men to till the soil. By the sweat of your brow you will eat your food, and women to bear children in similarly unhappy circumstances. I will make your pains in childbearing very severe. With painful labor you will give birth to children. Genesis 3:16. Hannah Arendt, in The Human Condition, makes the argument that nowhere in the Bible is it suggested that work itself is punishment for disobedience. God simply makes the labor more harsh. Others are simply reading Genesis through Hesiod. This might be true, but it doesn't really affect my argument, especially since Christians writing and thinking on the subject have assumed that was the meaning of the biblical passage for centuries. For instance, in 1664, Margaret Cavendish argued, "Neither can tennis be a pastime, for there can be no recreation in sweaty labor, for it is laid as a curse upon man that they shall live by the sweat of their brows." For the best discussion of the early Christian debates on Adam and Eve, which argues that it was St. Augustine who was really responsible for the notion that all humans are tainted and hence cursed because of original sin, see Pagels, 1988. Male productive labor is thus being framed here as the equivalent of childbirth, which, from a male point of view, not so much from a female one, but it is very much a male point of view being presented here, can seem about as close to pure creation ex nihilo, the infant appearing fully formed apparently out of nowhere, that human beings can perform. Yet it is also painful labor. This conception is still with us, for instance, in the way social scientists speak of production and reproduction. Etymologically, the English verb produce derives from the Latin producere, to bring forth, or put out, as one might still say, she produced a wallet from her handbag. Both the words production and reproduction are based on the same core metaphor. In the one case, objects seem to jump fully formed out of factories. In the other, babies seem to jump fully formed out of women's bodies. In neither case, of course, is this actually true, but as in so many patriarchal social orders, men like to conceive of themselves as doing socially or culturally what they like to think of women as doing naturally. Production is thus simultaneously a variation on a male fantasy of childbirth and of the action of a male creator god who similarly created the entire universe through the sheer power of his mind and words, just as men see themselves as creating the world from their minds and brawn, and see that as the essence of work, leaving to women most of the actual labor of tidying and maintaining things to make this illusion possible. On the origins of the Northern European notion of paid labor as necessary to the full formation of an adult human being. It's essential to emphasize the theological origins of this sort of thought. Most of the core assumptions of modern economics originally trace back to theological arguments. For instance, St. Augustine's argument that we are cursed with infinite desires in a finite world and thus naturally in a situation of competition with one another, which reappears in secular form in the 17th century in Thomas Hobbes, has become the basis for the assumption that rational human action is largely a matter of economizing the optimal allocation of scarce resources by rational actors in a competitive world. Of course, in the European Middle Ages, when economic matters fell under the jurisdiction of church law, no one really pretended these questions were not theological. Still, that period introduced a further element, not explicitly theological, the importance of which for later conceptions of labor can hardly be overstated. This is the notion of service. It is very much a Northern European idea. Much of the next section is a summary of an earlier essay of mine, Manners, Deference, and Private Property, 1997, itself an abbreviated version of my master's thesis, The Generalization of Avoidance, Manners, and Possessive Individualism in Early Modern Europe, Chicago, 1987. Some of the classic works on traditional Northern European marriage patterns and life cycle service include Hajnal, 1965-1982, Lazlett, 1972, 77, 83, 84, Stone, 1977, Casmall, 1981, and Wall, 1983. For a more recent survey of the state of the literature, see Cooper, 2005. The primary difference between Northern European and Mediterranean marriage patterns from the Middle Ages through the early modern period is that in the latter, while men also would often marry late, women married much earlier, and life cycle service was limited to certain social and professional groups, but in no sense a norm. In theory, feudal society was a vast system of service. Not only serfs, but also lower-ranking feudal lords served higher ones, just as higher ones provided feudal service to the king. However, the form of service that had the most important and persuasive influence on most people's lives was not feudal service, but what historical sociologists have called life cycle service. Essentially, almost everyone was expected to spend roughly the first 7 to 15 years of his or her working life as a servant in someone else's household. Most of us are familiar with how this worked itself out within craft guilds, where teenagers would first be assigned to master craftsmen as apprentices and then become journeymen, but only when they achieved the status of master craftsmen would they have the means to marry and set up their own households and shops and take apprentices of their own. In fact, the system was in no sense limited to artisans. Even peasants normally expected to spend their teenage years onward as servants in husbandry, in another farm household, typically that of someone just slightly better off. Service was expected equally of girls and boys. That's what milkmaids were, daughters of peasants during their years of service, and was usually expected even of the elite. The most familiar example here would be pages, who were apprentice knights, but even noble women, unless they were at the very top of the hierarchy, were expected to spend their adolescence as ladies-in-waiting. That is, servants who would wait upon a married noblewoman of slightly higher rank, attending to her privy chamber, toilette, meals, and so forth, even as they were also waiting for such time as they too were in a position to marry and become the lady of an aristocratic household themselves. Royal court similarly had gentlemen waiters who attended to the privy chamber of the king. Nowadays, of course, the word waiter is used only for those who wait tables at restaurants, a mainstay of the service economy, but the term was still being used primarily for domestic servants, ranking one step below the butler in Victorian households. The word dumbwaiter, for example, originally referred to the fact that servants who brought food to the master's table would often gossip about what they overheard people saying around it. Mechanical dumbwaiters performed the same function but could not speak. In the case of young nobles, waiting largely meant waiting for an inheritance, or for one's parents to decide one was old and sufficiently well-groomed to merit a transfer of title and property. This might be the case for servants in husbandry as well, but generally speaking, among commoners, servants were paid and expected to save a good share of their wages. So they were acquiring both the knowledge and experience needed to manage a household, shop, or farm, and also the wealth needed to acquire one, or, in the case of women, to be able to offer a dowry to a suitor able to do the same. As a result, medieval people married late, usually around 30, which meant that youth, adolescence, a time when one was expected to be at least a little wild, lustful, and rebellious, would often last a good 15 to 20 years. The fact that servants were paid is crucial because it meant that while wage labor did exist in Northern Europe, centuries before the dawn of capitalism, almost everyone in the Middle Ages assumed that it was something respectable people engaged in only in the first phase of their working life. Service and wage labor were largely identified. Even in Oliver Cromwell's time, day laborers could still be referred to as servants. Service, in turn, was seen above all as the process whereby young people learned not only their trade, but the manners, the comportment appropriate to a responsible adult. As one oft-quoted account by a Venetian visitor to England put it around 1500, "The want of affection in the English is strongly manifested toward their children. For after having kept them at home till they arrive at the age of 7 or 9 years at the utmost, they put them out, both males and females, to hard service in the households of other people, binding them generally for 7 to 9 years. This is inaccurate. Most were apprenticed in early adolescence. And these are called apprentices. And during that time, they perform all the most menial offices. And few are born who are exempted from this fate, for everyone, however rich he may be, sends away his children into the houses of others, whilst he, in return, receives those of strangers into his own. And on inquiring their reason for this severity, they answered that they did it in order that their children learn better manners. I have quoted it myself in the Manners paper. The translation goes back to Charlotte A. Sneed, a relation, or rather a true account of the island of England, with sundry particulars of the customs of these people, and the royal revenues under King Henry VII about the year 1500 by an Italian. Manners, in the medieval and early modern sense, went well beyond etiquette. The term referred to one's manner of acting and being in the world more generally, one's habits, tastes, and sensibilities. Young people were expected to work for wages in the households of others because, unless one was intending to join the clergy and become a scholar, what we would consider paid work and what we would consider education were seen as largely the same thing, and both were a process of learning self-discipline, about achieving mastery of one's baser desires, and learning how to behave like a proper self-contained adult. This is not to say that medieval and early modern culture had no place for the rambunctiousness of youth. To the contrary, young people, even though in service in others' households, typically also created an alternative culture of their own, centered on youth lodges with names such as the Lords of Misrule and Abbots of Unreason, which sometimes were even allowed to take temporary power during the popular festivals. Yet, ultimately, disciplined work under the direction of an adult head of a household was to transform the young into self-disciplined adults, at which point they would no longer have to work for others, but would be self-employed. As a result of such arrangements, attitudes toward work in medieval Northern Europe look quite different from those that prevailed in the classical world, or, even as we've seen, the later Mediterranean. The Venetian ambassador was scandalized by English practices. Most of our sources from Greek and Roman antiquity are male aristocrats who saw physical labor or service as fit only for women or slaves. Work, Aristotle insisted, in no sense makes you a better person. In fact, it makes you a worse one, since it takes up so much time, thus making it difficult to fulfill one's social and political obligations. As a result, the punishment aspect of work tended to be emphasized in classical literature, while the creative and godlike aspect was largely seen as falling to those male heads of household rich enough that they didn't actually have to get their hands dirty, but could tell others what to do. In Northern Europe in the Middle Ages and the Renaissance, almost everyone was expected to get their hands dirty at some point or another. In Renaissance England, for example, one frequent representative of the king was a noble servant entitled the Groom of the Stool because he was in charge of emptying the king's chamber pot. As a result, work, especially paid work, was seen as transformative. This is important because it means that certain key aspects of what was to become known as the Protestant work ethic were already there, long before the emergence of Protestantism. How, with the advent of capitalism, work came to be seen in many quarters either as a means of social reform or ultimately as a virtue in its own right, and how labor's countered by embracing the labor theory of value. No adequate history of the meanings of work has been written. C. Wright Mills, White Collar, The American Middle Classes, 1951. All this was to change with the advent of capitalism. By capitalism, here I am referring not to markets, these had long existed, but to the gradual transformation of relations of service into permanent relations of wage labor. That is, a relation between some people who owned capital and others who did not, and thus were obliged to work for them. What this meant in human terms was, first of all, that millions of young people found themselves trapped in permanent social adolescence. As the guild structures broke down, apprentices could become journeymen, but journeymen could no longer become masters, which meant that, in traditional terms, They would not be in a position to marry and start families of their own. They were expected to live their entire lives effectively as unfinished human beings. My father, for example, was for most of his life a plate stripper in offset photo lithography shops. At one point, while first learning my medieval history, I was telling him about the guild system. "Yes," he said, "I served an apprenticeship too. I retired as a journeyman printer." When I asked if there were any master printers, he said, "No, we don't have masters anymore." "Well, unless you want to say that's the boss." Inevitably, many began to rebel, give up on the interminable waiting, and began marrying early, abandoning their masters to set up cottages and families of their own, which in turn set off a wave of moral panic among the emerging employing class, very reminiscent of later moral panics about teenage pregnancy. The following is from The Anatomy of Abuses, a 16th century manifesto by a Puritan named Philip Stubbs. "And besides this, you shall have every saucy boy of 10, 14, 16, or 20 years of age catch up a woman and marry her without any fear of God at all, or, which is more, without any respect how they may live together with sufficient maintenance for their callings and estate. No, no, it maketh no matter for these things, so he have his pretty pussy to huggle withal, for that is the only thing he desireth. Then build they up a cottage, though but of elder poles in every lane end almost, where they live as beggars all their life after. This filleth the land with such store of mendicants, that in short time it is like to grow to great poverty and scarceness." This line of objection, of course, reached its peak with Malthus, who came to argue that the working classes would thus tend to breed everyone into poverty, and famously advocated fostering unsanitary conditions to kill them off. Kazanov, who is cited later, was a disciple of Malthus. It was at this moment that one can speak of the birth of the proletariat as a class, a term derived appropriately enough from a Latin word for those who produce offspring, since in Rome, the poor citizens who did not have enough wealth to tax were useful to the government only by producing sons who could be drafted into the army. Stubbs' Anatomy of Abuses might be considered the very manifesto of the Puritan Reformation of Manners, as they called it, which was very much a middle-class vision, with an equally jaundiced view of both the carnality of court life and the heathenish rioting of popular entertainment. It also shows it's impossible to understand debates about Puritanism and the origins of the Protestant work ethic without understanding this larger context of the decline of life cycle service and creation of a proletariat. English Calvinists, actually they were only called Puritans by those who disliked them, tended to be drawn from the class of master craftsmen and improving farmers who were employing this newly created proletariat, and their Reformation of Manners took special aim at popular festivals, gaming, drinking, and all the annual rites of misrule when youth temporarily inverted the social order. The Puritan ideal was for all such masterless men to be rounded up and placed under the stern discipline of a pious household whose patriarch could direct them in work and prayer. But this was just the first of a long history of attempts to reform the manners of the lower classes that has followed, from Victorian workhouses, where the poor were taught proper time discipline, to workfare and similar government programs today. Why, starting in the 16th century, did the middle classes suddenly develop such an interest in reforming the moral comportment of the poor, a subject they had not previously found of much interest one way or the other? This has always been something of a historical mystery. In the context of life cycle service, though, it actually makes perfect sense. The poor were seen as frustrated adolescents. Work, and specifically paid labor under the eye of a master, had traditionally been the means by which such adolescents learned how to be proper, disciplined, self-contained adults. While in practical terms, Puritans and other pious reformers could no longer promise much to the poor, certainly not adulthood as it used to be conceived, as freedom from the need to work under the orders of others, they substituted charity, discipline, and a renewed infusion of theology. Work, they taught, was both punishment and redemption, Work was self-mortification and as such had value in itself, even beyond the wealth it produced, which was merely a sign of God's favor, and not to be enjoyed too much. Max Weber's 1905 arguments about the relation of Calvinism and the origins of capitalism, I believe, should be understood in this light. That there was some connection between Protestantism, an ethic of self-disciplined work, and economic growth was considered self-evident by many of the time, but few examined the confluence of the three factors. Northern European life cycle service, Protestantism, and emerging capitalism, even though they appear to broadly coincide. After the Industrial Revolution, the celebration of work was taken up with renewed vigor by the Methodists, but even more, if anything, in educated middle-class circles that didn't see themselves as particularly religious. Perhaps its greatest advocate was Thomas Carlyle, an enormously popular essayist who, concerned with the decline of morality in the new age of mammon, proposed what he called a gospel of work. Carlyle insisted that labor should not be viewed as a way to satisfy material needs, but as the essence of life itself. God had intentionally created the world unfinished so as to allow humans the opportunity to complete his work through labor. A man perfects himself by working. Consider how, even in the meanest sorts of labor, the whole soul of man is composed into a kind of real harmony the instant he sets himself to work. Doubt, desire, sorrow, remorse, indignation, despair itself, all these like hell dogs lie beleaguering the soul of the poor day worker, as of every man. But he bends himself with free valor against his task, and all these are stilled. All these shrink murmuring far off into their caves. The man is now a man. The blessed glow of labor in him, is it not purifying fire, wherein all poison is burnt up? All true work is sacred. In all true work, were it but true hand labor, there is something of divineness. O brother, if this is not worship, then I say, the more the pity for worship, for this is the noblest thing yet discovered under God's sky. Who art thou that complainest of thy life of toil? Complain not. Look up, my wearied brother. See thy fellow workmen there in God's eternity, sacred band of the immortals, celestial bodyguard of the empire of mankind. Thomas Carlyle, past and present. It is interesting to contrast Carlyle's praise for work, for freeing the soul from cares, to Nietzsche, who condemned it for that very reason. In The Glorification of Work and the never-ceasing talk about the blessing of labor, I see fear of everything individual. For at the sight of work, that is to say, severe toil from morning till night, we have the feeling that it is the best police, that it holds everyone in check and effectively hinders the development of reason, of greed, and of desire for independence. For work uses up an extraordinary proportion of nervous force, withdrawing it from reflection, meditation, dreams, cares, love, and hatred. One wonders if this is a direct response to Carlyle. Carlyle was ultimately led to the conclusion so many reach today, that if work is noble, then the most noble work should not be compensated, since it is obscene to put a price on something of such absolute value. The wages of every noble work do yet lie in heaven or else nowhere, though he was generous enough to allow that the poor did need to be afforded fair wages in order to obtain the means to live. Much of the essay is a condemnation of capitalism as mammonism, and like so many 19th century works, sounds vaguely Marxist to the modern ear, even when it comes to conservative conclusions. Labor is not a devil, even while encased in mammonism. Labor is ever an imprisoned god, writhing unconsciously or consciously to escape out of mammonism. Such arguments were immensely popular in middle-class circles. Unsurprisingly, the workers' movement beginning to form in Europe around Carlyle's time was less impressed. Most workers involved in Luddism, Chartism, Ricardian socialism, and the various early strains of English radicalism would probably have agreed there was something divine in work, but that divine quality lay not in its effect on the soul and body, As laborers, they knew better than that, but that it was the source of wealth. Everything that made rich and powerful people rich and powerful was in fact created by the efforts of the poor. Adam Smith and David Ricardo, the founders of British economic science, had embraced the labor theory of value, as did many of the new industrialists, since it allowed them to distinguish themselves from the landed gentry, whom they represented as mere idle consumers. But the theory was almost instantly taken up by socialists and labor organizers and turned against the industrialists themselves. Before long, economists began seeking for alternatives on explicitly political grounds. Already in 1832, that is 35 years before the appearance of Marx's Capital, we encounter warnings like the following. That labor is the sole source of wealth seems to be a doctrine as dangerous as it is false, as it unhappily affords a handle to those who would represent all property as belonging to the working classes, and the share which is received by others as a robbery or fraud upon them. John Kasanoff, in Outlines of Political Economy, Being a Plain and Short View of the Laws Relating to the Production, Distribution, and Consumption of Wealth. As far as I know, the first use of the labor theory of value to argue that workers are exploited by their employers is found in a pamphlet called The Rights of Nature Against the Usurpations of Establishments, written by the British Jacobin John Thelwall in 1796. By the 1830s, many were, in fact, proclaiming exactly that. It is important to emphasize just how universally accepted the labor theory of value became in the generations immediately following the Industrial Revolution, even before the dissemination of Marx's works, which gave such arguments a renewed energy and a more sophisticated theoretical language. It was particularly powerful in Britain's American colonies. The mechanics and tradesmen who became the foot soldiers of the American War of Independence represented themselves as producers of the wealth that they saw the British crown as looting. And after the Revolution, many turned the same language against would-be capitalists. The solid rock on which their idea of the good society rested, as one historian put it, was that labor created all wealth. From Edward Pezin, Most Uncommon Jacksonians, the Radical Leaders of the Early Labor Movement. Failer's study of the town of Lynn in Massachusetts from 1780 to 1860 documents at length the degree to which the labor theory of value formed the framework of public debate for almost a century after the Revolution. The word capitalist at that time was largely a term of abuse. When U.S. President Abraham Lincoln delivered his first annual message to Congress in 1861, for instance, he included the following lines, which, radical though they seem to a contemporary ear, were really just a reflection of the common sense of the time. Marx's own works, for example, were little known in the U.S. at the time, though not completely unknown, since Marx himself was working as a freelance newspaper opinion writer and would often publish columns in U.S. papers. Marx, in his capacity as head of the Working Men's Association, also wrote directly to Lincoln with his own analysis of the American situation a few years later, in 1865, and while Lincoln seems to have read the letter, he had one of his adjuncts respond. Labor is prior to and independent of capital. Capital is only the fruit of labor and could never have existed if labor had not first existed. Labor is the superior of capital and deserves much the higher consideration. Still, Lincoln went on to insist, what made the United States different from Europe, indeed what made its democracy possible, was that it lacked a permanent population of wage laborers. There is not of necessity any such thing as the free hired laborer being fixed to that condition for life. Many independent men everywhere in these states a few years back in their lives were hired laborers. The prudent, penniless beginner in the world labors for wages a while, saves a surplus with which to buy tools or land for himself, then labors on his own account another while, and at length hires another new beginner to help him. In other words, even though he didn't put it quite this way, Lincoln argued that, owing to America's rapid economic and territorial expansion, It was possible there to maintain something like the old medieval system, in which everyone started out working for others, then used the proceeds of wage labor to set up shop or buy a farm on land seized from its indigenous inhabitants, and then eventually themselves play the capitalist, employing young people as laborers in their own right. This was definitely the ideal in pre-Civil War America, though Lincoln was from Illinois, not too far from the frontier. Working men's associations in the old cities of the Eastern Seaboard were already taking issue with arguments like this. Already in 1845, New York State Assemblyman Mike Walsh was arguing along explicitly anti-capitalist lines. What is capital but that all-grasping power which has been wrung by fraud, avarice, and malice from the labor of this and all ages past? What's significant here is that Lincoln felt he had to accept the labor theory of value as the framework of debate. Everyone did. This remained the case at least until the end of the century. It was true even along the western frontier, where one might have imagined European-style class tensions were least likely to flare up. In 1880, a Protestant home missionary who had spent some years traveling along the western frontier reported that you can hardly find a group of ranchmen or miners from Colorado to the Pacific who will not have on their tongue's end the labor slang of Dennis Kearney, the infidel ribaldry of atheist pamphleteer Robert Ingersoll, the socialistic theories of Karl Marx. E.P. Goodwin, in Home Missionary Sermon, 1880, in Josiah Strong, Our Country, Its Possible Future, and Its Present Crisis, 1891. Dennis Kearney was a California labor leader of the time, now remembered largely for his campaigning against Chinese immigration, and Robert Ingersoll, the author of well-known refutations of the Bible, is now mainly known secondhand through Clarence Darrow's arguments against the literal interpretation of Genesis in the play Inherit the Wind, which appear to be taken directly from Ingersoll's writings. I can add a personal testimony here. My own grandfather, Gustavus Adolphus Dolly Graeber, who, owing to my family's peculiarly long generations, was born before the U.S. Civil War and worked as a musician for many years along the western frontier at exactly the time Goodwin was writing. He is reputed to be the man who introduced the mandolin into American music. Was, my father once told me, an Ingersoll man, and hence a fervent atheist. He was never a Marxist, but my father became one later. Certainly a detail left out of every cowboy movie I ever saw. The notable exception being The Treasure of the Sierra Madre, which does indeed begin with a scene where John Huston, as a miner, explains the labor theory of value to Humphrey Bogart. The movie Treasure of the Sierra Madre is based on a novel of the same name by B. Traven, the pseudonym for a German anarchist novelist who fled his own country and lived most of the years of his life in southern Mexico. His real identity remains the object of speculation to this day. Concerning the key flaw in the labor theory of value as it became popular in the 19th century, and how the owners of capital exploited that flaw. Virtually any form of labor can be described as caring in the sense that it results in activities that help meet the needs of others. Nancy Fulber. I turn to America for a reason. The United States plays a key role in our story. Nowhere was the principle that all wealth derives from labor more universally accepted as ordinary common sense, yet nowhere, too, was the counterattack against this common sense so calculated, so sustained, and so ultimately effective. By the early decades of the 20th century, when the first cowboy movies were being made, this work was largely complete. And the idea that ranch hands had once been avid readers of Marx would have seemed as ridiculous as it would to most Americans today. Even more important, this counteroffensive laid the groundwork for the apparently bizarre attitudes toward work, largely emanating from North America, that we can still observe spreading across the world, with pernicious results. Lincoln was no doubt overstating his case, but it is nonetheless true that in the artisan's republic that existed before the Civil War, something roughly like the older tradition of life cycle service did endure, with the notable difference that most hired laborers were not called servants and did not live in their employers' homes. Politicians did see this as the ideal and legislated accordingly. Would-be capitalists were not granted the right to create limited liability corporations unless they could prove doing so would constitute a clear and incontestable public benefit. In other words, the notion of social value not only existed but was inscribed in law. This usually meant in practice only if they were proposing to dig a canal or build a railroad. Thus, for instance, when in 1837 the group of businessmen from Amherst, Massachusetts, proposed to create a limited liability carriage company, the proposal was opposed by a petition by journeymen on the grounds that, as journeymen, they looked forward to being their own masters when they would not have to relinquish to others the value they created, stating, "Incorporations put means into the hands of inexperienced capitalists to take from us the profits of our art, which has cost us years of labor to obtain, and which we consider to be our exclusive privilege to enjoy." Ordinarily, such requests were only approved if the company was dedicated to creating and maintaining public works of an obviously useful nature, such as a railroad or canal. Apart from the atheists along the frontier, much of this anti-capitalist feeling was justified on religious grounds. Popular Protestantism, drawing on its Puritan roots, not only celebrated work, but embraced the belief that, as my fellow anthropologists Dimitra Dukas and Paul Dernberger have put it, work was a sacred duty and a claim of moral and political superiority over the idle rich. A more explicitly religious version of Carlyle's Gospel of Work, most historians simply call it producerism, which insisted that work was both a value in itself and the only real producer of value. In the immediate wake of the Civil War, all this began to change with the first stirrings of large-scale bureaucratic corporate capitalism. The robber barons, as the new tycoons came to be called, were at first met, as the name given them implies, with extraordinary hostility. But by the 1890s, they embarked on an intellectual counteroffensive, proposing what Dukas and Dernberger call, after an essay by Andrew Carnegie, a gospel of wealth. The fledgling corporate giants, their bankers, and their political allies objected to producerist moral claims, and, starting in the 1890s, reached out with a new ideology that claimed, to the contrary, that capital, not labor, creates wealth and prosperity. Powerful coalitions of corporate interests made concerted efforts to transform the message of schools, universities, churches, and civic groups, claiming that business had solved the fundamental ethical and political problems of industrial society. Steel magnate Andrew Carnegie was a leader of this cultural campaign. To the masses, Carnegie argued for what we'd now call consumerism, the productivity of concentrated capital under the wise stewardship of the fit would so lower the price of commodities that the workers of tomorrow would live as well as the kings of the past. To the elite, he argued that coddling the poor with high wages was not good for the race. The promulgation of consumerism also coincided with the beginnings of the managerial revolution, which was, especially at first, largely an attack on popular knowledge. Where once Hoopers and Wainwrights and seamstresses saw themselves as heirs to a proud tradition, each with its secret knowledge, the new bureaucratically organized corporations and their scientific management sought as far as possible to literally turn workers into extensions of the machinery, their every move predetermined by someone else. The real question to be asked here, it seems to me, is why was this campaign so successful? Because it cannot be denied that, within a generation, producerism had given way to consumerism. The source of status, as Harry Braverman put it, was no longer the ability to make things, but simply the ability to purchase them. And the labor theory of value, which had meanwhile been knocked out of economic theory by the marginal revolution, had so fallen away from popular common sense that nowadays, only graduate students or small circles of revolutionary Marxist theorists are likely to have heard of it. Nowadays, if one speaks of wealth producers, people will automatically assume one is referring not to workers, but to capitalists. This was a monumental shift in popular consciousness. What made it possible? It seems to me that the main reason lies in a flaw in the original labor theory of value itself. This was its focus on production, a concept which, as earlier noted, is basically theological and bears in it a profound patriarchal bias. Even in the Middle Ages, the Christian God was seen as a craftsman and an artificer, and human work, which was always conceived primarily as male work, as a matter of making and building things, or perhaps coaxing them from the soil, while for women, labor was seen primarily and emblematically as a matter of producing babies. There is some debate over the relative weight, in medieval Christian theology, of the degree to which work was seen as an imitation of divine creation and as a means of perfecting the self, but both principles appear to have been present from the very beginning. Most real women's labor disappeared from the conversation. Obviously, the startling, unprecedented increases in productivity that followed in the wake of the Industrial Revolution played a role here too. They could only have led to arguments about the relative importance of machines and the people operating them, and indeed, those arguments remained at the center of political and economic debate throughout the 19th century. But even when it comes to factory labor, there is something of a darker story. The initial instinct of most early factory owners was not to employ men in the mills at all, but women and children. The latter were, after all, considered more tractable, and women especially more inured to monotonous, repetitive work. The results were often brutal and horrific. The situation also left traditional male craftsmen in a particularly distressing situation. Not only were they thrown out of work by the new factories, their wives and children, who used to work under their direction, were now the breadwinners. This was clearly a factor in the early wave of machine breaking during the Napoleonic Wars that came to be known as Luddism, and a key element in allaying that rebellion seems to have been a tacit social compromise whereby it came to be understood that it would be primarily adult men who would be employed in factory work. This, and the fact that for the next century or so, labor organizing tended to focus on factory workers, partly simply because they were the easiest to organize, led to the situation we have now, where simply invoking the term working class instantly draws up images of men in overalls toiling on production lines. And it's common to hear otherwise intelligent middle-class intellectuals suggest that, with the decline of factory work, the working class in, say, Britain or America no longer exists, as if it were actually ingeniously constructed androids that were driving their buses, trimming their hedges, installing their cables, or changing their grandparents' bedpans. In fact, there was never a time most workers worked in factories. Even in the days of Karl Marx or Charles Dickens, working-class neighborhoods housed far more maids, bootblacks, dustmen, cooks, nurses, cabbies, school teachers, prostitutes, caretakers, and costermongers than employees in coal mines, textile mills, or iron foundries. Are these former jobs productive? In what sense and for whom? Who produces a soufflé? It's because of these ambiguities that such issues are typically brushed aside when people are arguing about value. But doing so blinds us to the reality that most working-class labor, whether carried out by men or women, actually more resembles what we archetypically think of as women's work, looking after people, seeing to their wants and needs, explaining, reassuring, anticipating what the boss wants or is thinking, not to mention caring for, monitoring, and maintaining plants, animals, machines, and other objects, than it involves hammering, carving, hoisting, or harvesting things. This blindness has consequences. Let me give an illustration. In 2014, there was a transit strike when London's mayor threatened to close perhaps 100 London Underground ticket offices, leaving only machines. This sparked an online debate among certain local Marxists about whether the workers threatened with redundancy had bullshit jobs. The logic put forward by some being that Either a job produced value for capitalism, which the capitalists clearly no longer thought these jobs did, or else it served a social function that would be necessary even if capitalism did not exist, which clearly these did not, since under full communism, transport would be free. Needless to say, I was drawn in. Asked to respond, I eventually referred my interlocutors to a circular put out by the strikers themselves, called Advice to Passengers Using the Future London Underground. It included lines like these. Please ensure you are thoroughly familiar with London Underground's 11 lines and 270 stations before traveling. Please ensure that there are no delays in your journey, or any accidents, emergencies, incidents, or evacuations. Please do not be disabled, or poor, or new to London. Please avoid being too young or too old. Please do not be harassed or assaulted while traveling. Please do not lose your property or your children. Please do not require assistance in any way. It apparently never having occurred to many advocates of proletarian revolution to investigate what it is that transit workers actually did, they appear to have lapsed into something very like the right-wing tabloid stereotype of city employees as overpaid idlers lounging about on the public dime. What tube workers actually do, then, is something much closer to what feminists have termed caring labor. It has more in common with a nurse's work than a bricklayer's. It's just that, in the same way as women's unpaid caring labor is made to disappear from our accounts of the economy, so are the caring aspects of other working-class jobs made to disappear as well. One might make a case, perhaps, that British working-class traditions of caring labor do make themselves known in popular culture, which is largely a working-class product, with all the characteristic gestures, manners, and cadences by which working-class people cheer one another up reflected in British music, British comedy, and British children's literature. But it is not recognized as value-creating labor in itself. Caring labor is generally seen as work directed at other people, and it always involves a certain labor of interpretation, empathy, and understanding. To some degree, one might argue that this is not really work at all. It's just life, or life lived properly. Humans are naturally empathetic creatures, and to communicate with one another at all, we must constantly cast ourselves imaginatively into each other's shoes and try to understand what others are thinking and feeling, which usually means caring about them at least a little, but it very much becomes work when all the empathy and imaginative identification is on one side. The key to caring labor as a commodity is not that some people care but that others don't, that those paying for services, note how the old feudal term is still retained, feel no need to engage in interpretive labor themselves. This is even true of a bricklayer, if that bricklayer is working for someone else. Underlings have to constantly monitor what the boss is thinking. The boss doesn't have to care. That, in turn, is one reason, I believe, why psychological studies regularly find that people of working-class background are more accurate at reading other people's feelings, and more empathetic and caring than those of middle-class, let alone wealthy, backgrounds. To some degree, the skill at reading others' emotions is just an effect of what working-class work actually consists of. Rich people don't have to learn how to do interpretive labor nearly as well because they can hire other people to do it for them. Those hirelings, on the other hand, who have to develop a habit of understanding others' points of view, will also tend to care about them. As a result, underlings will also tend to care more about their superiors than their superiors will care about them, and this extends to almost any relation of structural inequality, men and women, rich and poor, black and white, and so on. It has always seemed to me this is one of the main forces that allows such inequalities to continue. I've discussed this in various places, but the curious listener might consult the second chapter of Graeber, Utopia of Rules. By this token, as many feminist economists have pointed out, all labor can be seen as caring labor, since, to turn to an example from the beginning of the chapter, even if one builds a bridge, it's ultimately because one cares about people who might wish to cross the river. As the examples I cited at the time make clear, people do really think in these terms when they reflect on the social value of their jobs. From this perspective, for instance, money, markets, finance are just ways of strangers alerting us to what they care about, because we care that caring is directed appropriately. Which implies, in turn, that contemporary banking is simply a bad form of caring labor insofar as it aims it in the wrong direction. To think of labor as valuable primarily because it is productive, and productive labor as typified by the factory worker, effecting that magic transformation by which cars or tea bags or pharmaceutical products are produced out of factories through the same painful but ultimately mysterious labor by which women are seen to produce babies, allows one to make all this disappear. It also makes it maximally easy for the factory owner to insist that no, actually, workers are really no different from the machines they operate. Clearly, the growth of what came to be called scientific management made this easier. But it would never have been possible had the paradigmatic example of worker in the popular imagination been a cook, a gardener, or a masseuse. Most economists nowadays see the labor theory of value as a curiosity from the formative days of the discipline. And it's probably true that, if one's primary interest is to understand patterns of price formation, there are better tools available. But for the workers' movement, and arguably for revolutionaries like Karl Marx, that was never the real point. The real point is philosophical. It is a recognition that the world we inhabit is something we made, collectively, as a society, and therefore that we could also have made differently. This is true of almost any physical object likely to be within reach of us at any given moment. Every one was grown or manufactured by someone on the basis of what someone imagined we might be like and what they thought we might want or need. It's even more true of abstractions like capitalism, society, or the government. They only exist because we produce them every day. John Holloway, perhaps the most poetic of contemporary Marxists, once proposed to write a book entitled Stop Making Capitalism. The book was eventually renamed Crack Capitalism 2010, which I've always felt was a far inferior title. After all, he noted, even though we all act as if capitalism is some kind of behemoth towering over us, it's really just something we produce. Every morning, we wake up and recreate capitalism. If one morning we woke up and all decided to create something else, then there wouldn't be capitalism anymore. There would be something else. One might even say that this is the core question, perhaps ultimately the only question, of all social theory and all revolutionary thought. Together, we create the world we inhabit. Yet if any one of us tried to imagine a world we'd like to live in, who would come up with one exactly like the one that currently exists? We can all imagine a better world. Why can't we just create one? Why does it seem so inconceivable to just stop making capitalism? Or government? Or at the very least, bad service providers and annoying bureaucratic red tape? Viewing work as production allows us to ask such questions. This couldn't be more important. It's not clear, however, if it gives us the means to answer them. It strikes me that recognizing that a great deal of work is not strictly speaking productive, but caring, and that there is always a caring aspect even to the most apparently impersonal work, does suggest one reason why it's so difficult to simply create a different society with a different set of rules. Even if we don't like what the world looks like, the fact remains that the conscious aim of most of our actions, productive or otherwise, is to do well by others. Often, very specific others. Our actions are caught up in relations of caring. But most caring relations require we leave the world more or less as we found it. In the same way that teenage idealists regularly abandon their dreams of creating a better world and come to accept the compromises of adult life at precisely the moment they marry and have children, caring for others, especially over the long term, requires maintaining a world that's relatively predictable as the grounds on which caring can take place. One cannot save to ensure a college education for one's children unless one is sure in 20 years there will still be colleges, or, for that matter, money. And that, in turn, means that love for others, people, animals, landscapes, regularly requires the maintenance of institutional structures one might otherwise despise. How, over the course of the 20th century, work came to be increasingly valued primarily as a form of discipline and self-sacrifice. We keep inventing jobs because of this false idea that everyone has to be employed at some sort of drudgery because, according to Malthusian Darwinian theory, he must justify his right to exist. Buckminster Fuller. However this may be, the gospel of wealth counteroffensive has been successful, and the captains of industry, first in America, then increasingly everywhere, have been able to convince the public that they, and not those they employ, are the real creators of prosperity. Their very success, however, created an inevitable problem. How are workers supposed to find meaning and purpose in jobs where they are effectively being turned into robots? Where they are actually being told they are little better than robots, even as, at the same time, they are increasingly expected to organize their lives around their work? The obvious answer is to fall back on the old idea that work forms character. And this is precisely what seems to have happened. One could call it a revival of Puritanism, but as we've seen, this idea goes much further back, to a fusion of the Christian doctrine of the curse of Adam with the Northern European notion that paid labor under a master's discipline is the only way to become a genuine adult. This history made it very easy to encourage workers to see their work not so much as wealth creation or helping others, or at least not primarily so, but as self-abnegation, a kind of secular hair shirt, a sacrifice of joy and pleasure that allows us to become an adult worthy of our consumerist toys. A great deal of contemporary research has confirmed this assessment. True, people in Europe or America have not historically seen their avocation as what should mark them in the eyes of eternity. Visit a graveyard. You will search in vain for a tombstone inscribed with the words steam fitter, executive vice president, park ranger, or clerk. In death, the essence of a soul's being on earth is seen as marked by the love they felt for and received from their husbands, wives, and children, or sometimes also by what military unit they served with in time of war. These are all things which involve both intense emotional commitment and the giving and taking of life. While alive, in contrast, the first question anyone was likely to have asked on meeting any of those people was, "What do you do for a living?" This continues to be the case. The fact that it does remains something of a stubborn paradox because the gospel of wealth and subsequent rise of consumerism was supposed to have changed all that. No longer were we to think of ourselves as expressing our being through what we produced, but rather through what we consumed. What sort of clothes we wear, music we listen to, sports teams we follow. Especially since the 70s, everyone has been expected to sort themselves out into tribal subcultures as sci-fi geeks, dog lovers, paintball enthusiasts, stoners, or supporters of the Chicago Bulls or Manchester United, but definitely not as longshoremen or catastrophe risk analysts. And it is true that on one level, most of us do prefer to think of ourselves as being defined by anything other than our jobs. One oft-quoted passage from Studs Terkel's Working. Unless a guy's a nut, he never thinks about work or talks about it. Maybe about baseball, or about getting drunk the other night, or he got laid, or he didn't get laid. I'd say 1 out of 100 really get excited about work. But at the same time, from the same testimony, somebody has to do this work. If my kid ever goes to college, I just want him to have a little respect. Yet somehow, paradoxically, people regularly report that work is what gives the ultimate meaning to their lives, and that unemployment has devastating psychological effects. There have been an enormous number of surveys, studies, inquests, and ethnographies of work over the course of the 20th century. Work about work has become a kind of minor industry in its own right. The conclusions reached by this body of research, And what follows appears to hold true, with only minor variations for both blue and white-collar workers virtually anywhere in the world, might be summarized as follows. 1. Most people's sense of dignity and self-worth is caught up in working for a living. 2. Most people hate their jobs. We might refer to this as the paradox of modern work. The entire discipline of the sociology of work, not to mention industrial relations, has largely been concerned with trying to understand how both these things can be true at the same time. As two paragons of the field, Al Jeaney and Terry Sullivan, put it in 1987, in well over 100 studies in the last 25 years, workers have regularly depicted their jobs as physically exhausting, boring, psychologically diminishing, or personally humiliating and unimportant. But at the same time, they want to work because they are aware at some level that work plays a crucial and perhaps unparalleled psychological role in the formation of human character. Work is not just a course of livelihood. It is also one of the most significant contributing factors to an inner life. To be denied work is to be denied far more than the things that work can buy. It is to be denied the ability to define and respect oneself. After many years of research on the topic, Jeaney finally came to the conclusion that work was coming to be considered less and less a means to an end, that is, a way of obtaining resources and experiences that make it possible to pursue projects, as I've put it, values other than the economic, family, politics, community, culture, religion, and more as an end in itself. Yet at the same time, it was an end in itself that most people found harmful, degrading, and oppressive. How to reconcile these two observations? One way might be to return to the arguments I made in Chapter 3 and to acknowledge that human beings essentially are a set of purposes, so that without any sense of purpose, we would barely be said to exist at all. There is surely truth in this. In some sense, we are all in the situation of the inmate who prefers working in the prison laundry to sitting in the cell watching TV all day. But one possibility the sociologists generally overlook is that if work is a form of self-sacrifice or self-abnegation, then the very awfulness of modern work is what makes it possible to see it as an end in itself. We have returned to Carlyle. Work should be painful. The misery of the job is itself what forms character. Workers, in other words, gain feelings of dignity and self-worth because they hate their jobs. This is the attitude that, as Clement observed, seems to remain in the air all around us, implicit in office small talk. The pressure to value ourselves and others on the basis of how hard we work at something we'd rather not be doing. If you're not destroying your mind and body via paid work, you're not living right. It is, to be sure, more common among middle-class office workers like Clement than among migrant farm workers, parking lot attendants, or short-order chefs. But even in working-class environments, the attitude can be observed through its negation, since even those who do not feel they have to validate their existence on a day-to-day basis by boasting how overworked they are will nonetheless agree that those who avoid work entirely should probably drop dead. In America, stereotypes of the lazy and undeserving poor have long been tied up in racism. Generations of immigrants learned what it means to be a hard-working American by being taught to despise the imagined indiscipline of the descendants of slaves, just as Japanese workers were taught to disdain Koreans or English workers Irish. Noel Ignatieff's How the Irish Became White is the classic study of this phenomenon. Nowadays, mainstream media is usually obliged to be more subtle, but there is an endless drumbeat of vilification of the poor, the unemployed, and especially those on public relief. And most people do seem to accept the basic logic of the contemporary moralists, that society is besieged by those who want something for nothing, that the poor are largely poor because they lack the will and discipline to work, that only those who do or have worked harder than they'd like to at something they would rather not be doing preferably under a harsh taskmaster, deserve respect and consideration from their fellow citizens. As a result, the sadomasochistic element in work described in Chapter 4, rather than being an ugly, if predictable, side effect to top-down chains of command in the workplace, has actually become central to what validates work itself. Suffering has become a badge of economic citizenship. It's not that much different than a home address. Without it, you have no right to make any other claim. We have come full circle then to the situation with which we began, but at least now we can understand it in its full historical context. Bullshit jobs proliferate today in large part because of the peculiar nature of managerial feudalism that has come to dominate wealthy economies, but to an increasing degree, all economies. They cause misery because human happiness is always caught up in a sense of having effects on the world, a feeling which most people, when they speak of their work, express through a language of social value. Yet at the same time, they are aware that the greater the social value produced by a job, the less one is likely to be paid to do it. Like Annie, they are faced with the choice between doing useful and important work like taking care of children, but being effectively told that the gratification of helping others should be its own reward and it's up to them to figure out how to pay their bills, or accepting pointless and degrading work that destroys their mind and body for no particular reason, other than a widespread feeling that if one does not engage in labor that destroys the mind and body, whether or not there is a reason to be doing it, one does not deserve to live. Perhaps we should leave the last word to Carlyle, who includes in his celebration of work one chapter that consists entirely of a peculiar diatribe against happiness. Here, he was responding to the utilitarian doctrines of men like Jeremy Bentham, who had proposed that human pleasure could be precisely quantified, and therefore all morality reduced to calculating what would provide the greatest happiness for the greatest number. The formula was later reduced to the greatest good for the greatest number, but Bentham's original theory was based on hedonistic calculation, and that's what Carlyle was responding to. Happiness, Carlyle objected, is an ignoble concept. The only happiness a brave man ever troubled himself with asking much about was happiness enough to get his work done. It is, after all, the one unhappiness of a man that he cannot work, that he cannot get his destiny as man fulfilled. Bentham and the utilitarians, who saw no purpose of human life other than the pursuit of pleasure, can be seen as the philosophical ancestors of modern consumerism, which is still justified by an economic theory of utility. But Carlyle's perspective isn't really the negation of Bentham's. Or if it is, then only in the dialectical sense, where two apparent opposites remain permanently at war with one another, their advocates unaware that in their struggle, they constitute a higher unity which would be impossible without both. The belief that what ultimately motivates human beings has always been, and must always be, the pursuit of wealth, power, comforts, and pleasure, has always and must always be complemented by a doctrine of work as self-sacrifice, as valuable precisely because it is the place of misery, sadism, emptiness, and despair. As Carlyle put it, "All work, even cotton spinning, is noble. Work is alone noble, be that here said and asserted once more. And in like manner, too, all dignity is painful. A life of ease is not for any man. Our highest religion is named the worship of sorrow. For the Son of Man, there is no noble crown, well worn or even ill worn, but there is a crown of thorns."